Coming up, our panel of journalists looks back at the major religion news stories of the year past and a faith-based effort to stop foreclosures and keep families in their homes.
We have to come together to make something happen because it's just not right.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Tim O'Brien, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. As 2008 comes to a close, the worldwide financial crisis continues to reverberate. Pope Benedict XVI addressed the crisis in his annual New Year's message. He said the quest for quick profit has ignored consideration for the common good, and that the conscience of humanity can no longer ignore the growing divide between the rich and the poor. Now, Bob Abernethy and our panel of journalists discuss the major religion stories of the past year.
We look back now at 2008 with the help of Kim Lawton of Religion and Ethics News Weekly, Roland Martin, a CNN commentator who joins us from Chicago, and E.J. Dion, a columnist for The Washington Post and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to you all.
Good to be with you.
E.J., we had an election in this past year. And the question is, what are the messages that come to you from the campaign and the vote?
I don't think we've ever had an election that was so rich in messages. The obvious is still the most important. This is a country that began as a country with slavery. African-American slaves came over from Africa at the beginning of the 17th century. We were a racially segregated country less than 50 years ago in parts of our country. And we elected Barack Obama, an African-American, indeed somebody whose parents, a biracial family, where their marriage would have been illegal in a lot of states in our country. That's an extraordinary thing. It wouldn't have happened without an overwhelming mobilization of the African-American community, and it wouldn't have happened if 60% of the votes he got, roughly a little more than that, came from white people. So this is an extraordinary thing in a democracy. I think the other thing, I've been playing in my head with the slogan, change we can believe in. We focused a lot on change, but there are two other words that are interesting. One is the word we. And I think there was a sense of a more communitarian country coming out of this election, where he talked a lot about rebuilding community in the country. And believe is an important word, not in the religious sense, but in the sense that people wanted more confidence in their government and their political system. And that's what he promised in this election.
Mm-hmm. And Roland Martin in Chicago, the messages that came through to you, what?
Sure. I want to pick up what E.J. just said, because that is a critical point. On November 4th, when Obama gave his victory speech, he used the word we 47 times. If you study this campaign all throughout, from the primary to the general election, whenever you heard Senator Hillary Clinton talk, she always said what I want to do as president. Whenever you heard Senator John McCain talk, he always said what I am going to do as president. Obama always talked about we, us, our. And so that was a challenge, if you will, to America. And, you know, I've sort of been speaking on this topic for about the last couple of months, and I think about Nehemiah and the rebuilding of the wall. He had a vision, but he said the people must agree, and then they said, let us rebuild. So the challenge he constantly gave, which I think the American people bought into, was not just what I can do as president, but what we can do as a nation. So the challenge going forward is how the nation is going to respond to their role and responsibility, as opposed to what he is going to do in the White House.
And Kim, the message is for you.
Well, I was fascinated, of course, by some of the things these guys have talked about, but also just the incredible role religion played on every front throughout this campaign. You had both parties actively reaching out to people of faith. And frankly, for the Democrats, that was a new thing. You hadn't seen that in quite a while. You had a Democratic candidate who was religious and comfortable about talking about his faith. But you also had questions about whether a Mormon could be president. You had questions about whether a Southern Baptist pastor should be president. What about a Muslim? And all the, you know, rumors about whether Barack Obama was a Muslim or not. You had questions about evangelicals and are they going to stay with John McCain, controversial ministers. Every time you turned around, religion played a key role, and that was really fun to watch. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really important point Kim makes. I mean, for Democrats, I've joked that Democrats discovered God in the 2004 exit polls. You know, they realized that religious Americans were very important to George Bush's victories. And I think Barack Obama, more than any Democrat in a while, really tried to speak directly to religious Americans, including those he knew were going to vote against him. You know, he gave a very powerful speech in 06. The speech he gave after the Jeremiah Wright controversy had sort of important religious overtones. And so I think we're going to have a different conversation about religion going forward.
Right. Let me ask Roland.
You know what? I think one of the reasons for that, and let me touch on that, that is the Democrats used to understand the role of religion. And that is when you study the Civil Rights Movement, that was a religious movement that morphed into a social movement. It also touched upon the Democratic Party nationally. The party then got away from that. I think what you're seeing is you're seeing politicians who now recognize that people's faith is not a part of who they are. Many, it is the essence of who they are. And that is, they're looking at issues today through their faith. They're looking at climate change. They're looking at the issue of marriage and abortion. They're looking at parenting. They're looking at values, not just simply saying, well, this is what I'm going to do within the comfort of my home. Well, this is what I do every single day, no matter whether I'm at work or at home. That, I think, is something we must watch for as to how people say faith is now playing a role in every facet of our lives.
And meanwhile, EJ, Kim, we had a recession. We have a recession, even a collapse of the financial system. Again, this question of messages, what does it say?
Well, you know, when the commandment says, thou shalt not steal, that's about our economic life, not just about somebody hitting you over the head. And I think that what we're seeing here is sort of a new engagement of our ethical responsibilities within the economy. The other thing is that, you know, a lot of times in political campaigns, you hear the slogan, we're all in this together. I think hard times are moments when we really are all in this together, when there's much more of that feeling that we can feel confident being off on our own when times are good and we have a sense that I can make it myself. I think in this kind of period, people look to each other a little bit more.
But historically, there's been some conflict between different parts of a society when times get tough.
Oh, that's true. I mean, there can be class warfare, and you've seen some of that fighting around the bailouts. I mean, the argument that we bailed out the finance industry easily, we're not so easy about bailing out the car industry. Does that mean there are a lot of blue-collar workers there? So, yes, you're seeing this kind of conflict in the society. But still, when you look at our history, if you look at the New Deal, that was very much a we kind of period. I always think of It's a Wonderful Life as the quintessential New Deal movie, and George Bailey as the figure of that kind of we.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say briefly, it's had a real impact practically, though, when you're talking about religious institutions are the places where people go when times are tough. And a lot of these religious institutions are affected themselves. So at a time when they're getting more and more requests for help from people, they're, you know, don't have the same budget. They're having a hard time keeping their light bills paid. So it has, for the religious community, very practical effects.
And Roland,
I believe this recession shows how people of faith have failed themselves when it comes to their faith. We have been absolutely horrible stewards of our resources. Whenever we talk about Americans being in debt, I mean, we have more debt than we've ever had, ever. And so we were sitting here buying houses and cars and we're taking vacations. Even people within the body of the church do the exact same thing. And all of a sudden, when it all crumbles, people then say, oh my God, Lord Jesus or Allah or Buddha or whatever it is, oh, please help me out of this mess. When God is sitting here saying, well, you know what? I tried to help you when you're in the middle of it. I think you're seeing a back to basics mentality. You're seeing very few gospel of prosperity folks championing that whole theory. They're not recognizing that we cannot keep talking about accruing more and more and more without recognizing that our resources are finite.
Let me try. We could talk about this all day. Kim, you covered the Episcopalians this year as the year before. Four Episcopal dioceses have now left the Episcopal Church USA.
Well, the ongoing discussions and struggles over homosexuality, the consecration of a gay bishop, issues of theology continue to, you know, really split the not only the U.S. Episcopal Church, but the entire worldwide Anglican Communion that the U.S. Episcopal Church is part of. Big development this year, the conservative groups, some of them entire dioceses that left the Episcopal Church, are trying to form their own rival church body here in the U.S. that would still be Anglican. So in other words, it would still be part of the worldwide Anglican Communion, but not part of the U.S. Episcopal Church. And this is really unprecedented for the Anglican Communion, if it indeed goes forward.
Yeah. Some of us who have experience with Baptists and Methodists and others would say, well, what's so bad about splitting?
Well, the thing of it is, they don't want to completely split because they still want to be part of the worldwide church. And the worldwide church just isn't organized that way.
Can't there be two Anglican groups within the United States? Well, that's what the conservatives are
hoping for. But, of course, the Episcopalians, the establishment Episcopalians, are saying, no, we are the expression of Anglicanism in the U.S. And the other thing is, it gets very complicated when you're talking about church property, money, and authority. Mm. Who's in charge? Who answers to whom under this kind of scenario? But that's what, you know, they're going to try to work out.
A great story in 2008 was what happened in California with Proposition 8 and the aftermath to it. You were covering that, too.
Well, again, this shows that the issue of homosexuality is roiling not only the church, but American society. Gay marriage was briefly legalized in California. Then the voters turned that back. And religious conservatives were a key part of that movement. Ironically, a lot of the voters who came out for Barack Obama, who were mobilized by his candidacy, helped defeat gay marriage in California. And that's really set off a big backlash within the gay community and, you know, a lot of protests.
Mm-hmm. And E.J., the Pope came to the United States in this past year and was very well received.
He was. And that trip was enormously successful in the sense that his approval ratings after that trip were much higher than before. Why was that? I think it's because he, far more than anyone I think expected him to, devoted the trip to a kind of apology and penance for the pedophilia scandal in the church. He came back to that again and again and again. When you saw the reaction to the trip afterward, I think what you found is more conservative Catholics were a little bit disappointed that he hadn't taken a harder line. I think more progressive Catholics were relieved that he didn't take a harder line. But I think he understood how much damage that scandal had caused the church, and he did everything in his power to say, I understand that, and I want to do something about it.
It was interesting because he came under the shadow of John Paul II, who was so beloved. And people didn't really know Benedict, or if they did, they didn't think they liked him very much. And this trip really was a debut for him. And it gave people an opportunity to see him. And so despite the, you know, some disappointments and whatever, I think that he came away with people really getting a new affection for him.
I want to ask you you all, if any one of you wants to take on this question about the ethical lapses in 2008. You know, John Edwards and the governor of Illinois and the governor of New York. Does anyone want to try to explain, Roland? Maybe you can try to explain it.
Why
people who are prominent and powerful think they can get away with doing something wrong?
Because I think what happens is whether you're prominent, whether you are somebody no one frankly knows other than your family, and that is you think about the consequences after you've gotten in trouble. And so what I sort of remember Michael Irvin when he got in trouble years ago and he came home and he was scared to death of what his wife was going to say when he got busted with a couple of women. And she said, oh, I'm not your problem. Sandy said, that's between you and God. And so what happens is people make these decisions not thinking that, wait a minute, how can I sit here and talk about my faith and talk about what it means to be a godly man and a godly woman, then I do something completely different than what I've been talking about. And so I think what has to happen is people have to get back into, and also accountability must come in as well. You know, I think you have to have people around you who are also holding you accountable, accountability partners as well. We've gotten away from that. We've got people around you who are buddies who go along with you, as opposed to saying, no, we're going to walk on the straight and narrow together, because there's too much that you can lose too much, frankly, if you go down this particular path, not just material, but also your personal integrity, which is difficult to get back.
Yeah. Reinhold Niebuhr famously said, original sin is the only empirically verifiable doctrine of the Christian church. And no matter how famous you are, you can fall.
Kim, very quickly, Rich Cizik and his resignation as the chief lobbyist in Washington for the National Association of Evangelicals. A lot of people are reading a great deal of significance into that. You want to take that?
Well, it's part of, I think, the growing discussions that have been going on within the religious right among religious conservatives about what their agenda should be. Richard Cizik is one who had advocated creation care, he called it, you know, concern about the environment. He got into trouble most recently for suggesting that he could accept civil unions, not gay marriage, but same-sex benefits for same-sex couples. And that's another issue that some evangelicals, especially younger evangelicals, are becoming more tolerant than their parents were. So I think that symbolized some of the greater conversations that are going on about the agenda and what it should be and what it should be in the future.
I thought that was fascinating. Go ahead, Roland.
Can I say this, please? And look, I understand religious conservatives and those who look at the issue of gay marriage from a religious standpoint. But I think where religious people are failing is that they are not articulating on a national level the outrage of what we're seeing when it comes to heterosexual marriage, when it comes to our divorce rate. I mean, if you took the same level of energy that people of faith have towards gay marriage and apply that when it comes to saving marriages or keeping people from entering those marriage that end in divorce, we might see a change there as well. And so
Roland,
I believe that if you're going to attack one, attack the other.
Okay, Roland, that's the last word.
Amen.
Thanks to Roland Martin, joining us from Chicago, to Kim Lawton, and to E.J. Dionne. Next week, our look ahead to what we expect in 2009.
In other news, President-elect Barack Obama plans to use the same Bible at his swearing-in that Abraham Lincoln used at his first inauguration. Obama will be the first president to use it since Lincoln. A spokesman for Obama said the president-elect is deeply honored that the Library of Congress is making the Bible available. In Washington, members of the clergy and advocates for the homeless gathered for an annual memorial service for homeless people who have died. The service calls attention to the problem of people living on the streets, especially this time of year. It was held on December 21st, the first day of winter, with the longest and sometimes one of the coldest nights of the year.
It is the darkest night, and it points to the darkest thing in our society. And the darkest thing in our society is homelessness.
The problem of homelessness has become even more pressing with the soaring numbers of foreclosures around the country. A new report from the international financial group Credit Suisse projects that at current rates, 16%, one of six of all U.S. mortgages will be in foreclosure over the next 4 years. Banks and other big businesses have lobbyists advocating on their behalf. But who's looking out for the interests of troubled homeowners? Kim Lawton has our report on a faith-based effort to help families keep their homes.
It's a long-standing Mexican-American Christmas tradition called Las Posadas. In a procession, parishioners reenact Joseph and Mary's search for lodging in Bethlehem. They knock, but they're told there's no room in the inn. Here in Antioch, California, an epicenter of the foreclosure crisis, church leaders say the story of Las Posadas was especially poignant this year.
You feel the sense of rejection that is very real for people nowadays, losing home, not finding the shelter that they want, not finding the acceptance, feeling rejected by human beings or by God, by the institutions or whatever.
Raul Dionda and his wife Lorena can relate all too well. Lorena is 9 months pregnant, and the family has been fighting an uphill battle to avoid foreclosure. They bought their house in 2003 with an adjustable rate mortgage. Then the economy started going bad. The Diandas have a mortgage of nearly $400,000 and have spent thousands more fixing the place up. But the house is now worth only $180,000. Raul's hours at his construction job were cut back, and at the same time, the bank kept raising the interest rate on the mortgage. The rate went over 11%, and they couldn't keep up.
The month of May of this year, where we see, okay, we are $300 short to make the house payment, and the fridge is empty. I don't want that to happen to any family.
But it is happening to millions of families. California has one of the hardest-hit housing markets in the country, with an average of one out of roughly every 200 homes being foreclosed. The situation has been especially tough in the outer suburbs of San Francisco, such as Antioch and nearby Stockton, which has been dubbed the nation's foreclosure capital. In the midst of it all, faith-based groups are taking a lead role in trying to find solutions.
We think it's important that the faith community really create a vision for this society where there's a focus on the common good. And so many families are being hurt by this, and families are a real key of all types to our society.
Tom Amato is director of PACT, People in Congregations Together, an interfaith group in San Joaquin County. PACT and the Homeowners Task Force co-sponsored a foreclosure fair at a local United Methodist church.
Did your mortgage payment go up?
That's correct.
Troubled homeowners met with housing counselors and got advice about their particular situation. They heard about programs that might help them, and some consulted with bank representatives about the possibility of modifying their loans. Hundreds came from many ethnic and economic backgrounds, showing the magnitude of the crisis.
We're all suffering from the top to the very bottom. We are talking to regular people, doctors, lawyers, police officers. We're all impacted. It does not discriminate. It's not prejudice. It's everywhere.
Arlonda Pirtle is on the PACT Housing Committee. She is frustrated by the perception that all troubled homeowners are reaping the consequences of irresponsible loan decisions. In fact, she says many were unlucky victims of falling home values, while others were simply taking advantage of legal loan programs promoted and approved by the banks.
They want to blame us as homeowners for that, but they offered it. We took advantage of it. So now they want to blame everything on us. It's both-sided, not just the homeowners. The bank needs to take the hits for those as well.
Some of the volunteers face foreclosure themselves. Ana Reynoso is a real estate agent whose business collapsed after the housing bubble burst. Her home has plummeted in value. She can't sell it and says she may lose it any day now. Ana and others in the Faith Network say while helping individual homeowners is important, the most effective solutions will only come through systemic changes. And those, they believe, will only happen through a massive grassroots effort.
We have to get together. We have to come together to make something happen because it's just not right. A lot of communities are getting broken up.
Tonight, our purpose is to stand up for a real change.
Raul Dionda is also part of that grassroots coalition. When he got into mortgage trouble, he sought help from his local Catholic parish.
Stand up and make some noise. You want a real change.
The church is really important because they give us all the moral support that we need, you know, say, okay, you guys, you're not alone.
I think the church has in many ways been a mediating institution in the United States culturally, one of those institutions that helps people come together in good times and in bad times. And so certainly people feel a certain confidence, a certain openness from the church to help when times are not so good.
The church put Dionda in touch with activists who help him push the bank for a loan modification. Now he's helping rally people in the policy battle on the local and national level.
Every working man, working family has to have a home. But it has to have a home where they can afford to pay on their salary.
God is going to send us a miracle.
The National Network of Faith-Based Community Groups called PICO is leading the campaign to stop preventable foreclosures and to put bank-owned vacant property back into the hands of families. They're lobbying government officials for a national standardized loan modification program and for more regulation of banks and loan servicers. And they say not just banks, but troubled homeowners as well should get some of the government's $700 billion bailout.
It is about families at risk. But it's also about the many congregations, Christian, Jewish, and Muslim, who are trying valiantly to help those families at risk weather the storm.
A matter of justice, a matter of equality to opportunity, a matter of keeping our society cohesive.
The Diondas are among the very few who have made some progress, albeit temporary progress. Just before Christmas, the bank granted them a loan modification and lowered their payments for the next 6 months. In the meantime, the DeAndas will be trying to convert the loan into a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. They're determined to hang on.
The home is the most important thing for a family. Without a home, I don't think it can be a complete family.
And they say working with the faith-based network gives them hope that they will indeed succeed. I'm Kim Lawton in Antioch, California.
That's our program for now. I'm Tim O'Brien. Happy New Year. There's much more on our website, including more about religion and politics on our One Nation page. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org.